We get it almost every night, and when that moon gets big and bright, it's supernatural delight. Every border was dancing in the moonlight.
Hello, I'm Carol.
Hello, I'm Susan. Welcome to Kickapoo Nightlife, a news magazine exploring our world after sunset. We'll explore how dark nights and dark skies affect human health, as well as news on how you can have effective, efficient, affordable lighting that also helps all the birds, bugs, and critters who, like us, need dark skies to be healthy.
We'll talk with astronomers, photographers, scientists, artists, engineers, and even some of your neighbors about the stars and planets in the sky, what goes on at night in the land around us and the world at large, and the technology and innovations from around the world that are improving our lives through smart, efficient lighting.
The sponsor for today's program is Goldenrod, a plant with a flower that crowns the prairie in August.
Today, we are going to visit Mount Lemmon Observatory with Susan to hear about exploring the night sky, and then we'll find out about a big event that's going to be occurring in this month's night sky that you are not going to want to miss. But first, the phenology report for August. In wetlands, dragonflies and damselflies quickly dart over ponds. Bobcat kittens are born in dens found in caves, rock crevices, or hollow logs or trees. Listen for crickets singing in the air. Watch for sulfur butterflies gathering around puddles. Butterfly watching is at its best this month. Acorns fall from trees, providing meals for hungry wood ducks, deers, and turkeys. The prairie purple cornflower is in bloom. Jewel weed's orange blossoms. Later, when this touch-me-not has ripened, help send seeds shooting by simply touching a bulging seed pod. They are quicker than the eye. Wild blueberries ripening, awaiting hungry hikers and bears to strip them from the vine. Warblers, shorebirds, and nighthawks begin to migrate south. Wood duck families can be seen floating along rivers and ponds near overhanging branches in hollow standing trees. Late summer prairies burst into color. Look for blazing stars, Leantris, in full bloom, accompanied by goldenrods and asters. Native prairie grasses, like big and little blue stem, shoot up seed stalks, and summer blooming trees and shrubs begin heavy fruit production. Late August is when monarchs begin gathering and initiating their multi-generational journey to Mexico. Tagging programs typically peak in the latter half of the month. Bumblebees and various native butterflies remain highly active around late-blooming flowers and thistle. Shorebirds are already moving south and stopping in Wisconsin's wetlands and mudflats. Many residents finish raising their clutches and begin wandering in small mixed species of flocks.
You are listening to WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin. Well, today we're visiting Mount Lemmon Observatory near Tucson, Arizona, where I spent an afternoon and an evening touring the facility and looking through the telescopes. It was an amazing, wonderful day and night on that mountain. I was so impressed with everything up there. And so we're going to listen to a recording of an interview I did with Joe Hoshide, who's the site manager. And he was my host for that visit. And he took me on a tour into all the different telescopes on the mountain and the maintenance buildings and the offices and the computer rooms and everything. I really saw the whole mountain, I think. And then we did astronomy that night with a group of people. So we'll listen to some of our walk around the mountaintop and through the telescope silos. They have 60-inch giant mirror telescopes to one that's small enough to fit on a little trailer. And they're just looking at the night sky in a lot of different ways up there. Scientists from a lot of countries, as well as many places in the U.S., use these telescopes. On my tour, right at sunset, we looked through a telescope at the surface of the sun a little bit before sunset. And that's really amazing. If you ever get a chance to look at through a solar telescope, you should do it. And as the sun set over the mountains on the western horizon, we were really fortunate to see a green flash. And maybe some listeners have seen one. It's a very clear, large, bright green flash around the sun as it lowers below the horizon. And we saw a really good one. So that was a pretty special part of the evening up there. I interviewed Joe on site, and we were walking outdoors and in and out of these big metal silos. So the sound is a bit rough because the conditions were windy and then echoey in the buildings. We went in one silo that was so small we had to crouch to get through the door. There was just a lot of awkward situations for recording. So I apologize for the variable sound quality. And I hope you get a little taste of what it was like to walk in and out of these big telescopes. Here we go to Mount Lemmon.
What kind of training do you have to do this job?
Oh, sure. So I started the U of A in 1991, and I was undecided. And I've always loved natural sciences, and my grandpa got me a telescope. So I started, I took astronomy as an elective, and took astronomy 110A, then the spring semester is 110B. And at the end of that semester, I wanted to figure out, like, how can I get involved in astronomy over the summer, and I was told to talk to the Mountain Operations Group, because they hire summer students. So I got hired as a summer student. I lived for 4 summers as a college student up here at this observatory, and took some astronomy classes, but I realized at that point in my life, I thought, I'm going to keep astronomy as a hobby, and I actually got my degree in wildlife and fisheries biology.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And moved to California, worked for Fish and Game, came back into Tucson, ran into my old boss, the director of Mountain Ops, and he said, hey, we're hiring for a resident to live up here. And that's when my wife and I started. We lived in the house right up there. And that was in 2005. So I think a science degree is valuable in that it can be applied across different disciplines, mm-hmm. because the core things like, you know, scientific method and your math and chemistry and stuff, you know, can be used in different fields. And so for my job, even though my degree's in biology, there's still useful things that I studied. Mm-hmm. And then it's just been on hands experience for the past, so it'll be 20 years on May 9th.
Okay, because you, to know all these systems, the mechanics of it, the mm-hmm. electronics, the plumbing, what the scientists need, just seems like you'd need 5 engineer degrees.
No, it is. We all work together. I think the biggest thing to pull it off to make it all work is that we all work together
mm-hmm.
as a team.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things I love the most about our group is that you ride up and down in the mountain, you know, for 3 hours a day with people, and they become like family too.
Mm-hmm.
So all the people I work with, we're all very close.
Mm-hmm.
We get together and that's, you know, we were on the phone, like, how are we going to cover this storm?
Mm-hmm.
And so we communicate regularly, and I think the teamwork is what makes it
right.
makes it work.
Yeah, that's so true
yeah.
in so many things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll show you
yeah.
their control room, and we can go look
Ooh,
at the telescope.
Control rooms are fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, that I think that Citizen Science Project, you know, people are interested.
Yes.
Is a cool way to get involved in doing this stuff.
We have a real strong population area involved in all kinds of citizen science and naturalist kind of things. I mean, I go out and lead and teach a bunch of different things in the woods, and I run astronomy things at night a lot, year-round out there. And we have people who are astronomers who will probably jump on this, but we have bird watchers and people looking in the streams for things. I mean, there's quite a lot of that going on where I am. So there's people who'd perk up and go, my teenager is going to Yale to study astronomy, and he'll, you know, there's that. There's quite a bit of that there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
That's wonderful. Yeah, that project, so far we've reported, I think, 4,500 main belt objects. We discovered four NEOs with it, just on their own.
And that's just Joe Public.
Yeah.
Finding, right?
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool.
Citizen science, once people know that they can do that with different things besides bird watching, they get really excited because they had no idea they could contribute like that, you know. So
right. We tried to make it exactly as if you worked for the survey, you were at the telescope, you would see the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Talking about on Mount Lemmon, the summit here, we're at 9,157 feet. This is the biggest. There's two 60 inches up here. Is this one, and there's one on the other end of the site.
Mm-hmm.
What's really cool is you look out across this valley.
And we are looking at the San Pedro River Valley. And what's that mountain range over
there? The Galileros.
Galileros.
Yep.
And beyond that?
Are the Pinaleos.
Yeah, we've got a long view here to mountains far away. It's really spectacular.
In the snow-capped mountain, so you'll hear about the LBT, the Large Binocular Telescope.
Yeah.
So if you, it's hard to point out right now, we don't have binoculars, but on a clear day when it's not quite as hazy, where the white is on the snow in the very far back, you can see the LBT from
mm-hmm.
here, which is cool. It's a giant box on the telescope. We'll walk around behind here in a minute, and I'll show you where the Catalina and Saddlebrook and everything is expanded. Telescope that it, so one facet of astronomical research that they're getting into down at the U of A, space situational awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And so a professor there is working with Adam Block. They have a telescope in here, and between this and an instrument at the 61 inch, they're looking at like space junk and satellites.
Ooh, yeah.
And things like that. And so that's what this is.
Okay, so
here.
This is a little trailer. It's like a 10-12 foot trailer. And it's got a metal box on it. It looks like a little camper house with no windows. And inside of it is all this equipment.
There's a telescope there, and it's called Pomenus. And so if you go to, you can look up Pomenus, and there's a whole website on
mm-hmm.
it. This telescope is a 40-inch. I'll show you here. So this is run, what's kind of cool is this is run from South Korea.
Oh, this and, is this, yeah.
Yeah, and so at night here, it's during the day there, so they don't have to stay up all night to get their data, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So
they're never actually here. It's all
remote. And there is a group in Tucson called ACE, it's Astronomical Consulting and Engineering, and they help maintain the telescope. Sorry, my key is... What typically happens is you get ice and snow that builds up behind the shutter.
Yeah.
And we don't have any built-in heating systems to melt the ice
mm-hmm.
and snow off the domes. So we rely on the sun to melt things. And usually after a snowstorm in Arizona, you know, have maybe two or three bad days where the weather's really bad. The sun will come out, and that next night where it's clear, the humidity is usually too high anyway to
mm-hmm.
observe. But we need to let a day or two of sun melt the
mm-hmm.
melt the snow and the
mm-hmm.
ice. So usually we lose, you know, obviously you lose the days of the storm, and you lose another day or two after the
mm-hmm.
storm before
mm-hmm.
they can ramp back up.
Yeah.
On the shell design. And you know, we said pluses and minuses of each dome. This one doesn't, it's not as weatherproof, but the positive of it is when it's open, the telescope is actually exposed. And so for seeing and thermal for the air to equalize temperature-wise mm-hmm. inside and out, this is actually better for seeing.
It looks tight, though.
Yeah, oh, yeah. You should see this thing barely clears in here. So this is a 50 inch.
The automated opens and closes by itself.
Different looking telescope.
Yes.
Than the other one over there, which looks more like a regular telescope pointing up. This one looks like a bowl pointing up.
Yes, and the one over there is kind of neat because it's the struts and the components are made of carbon fiber.
Mm-hmm.
This is all steel here. Remember we talked about the laboratory where we recoat the mirrors?
Right.
So like this is, we recoat mirrors like this. So during the summer shutdown period, when we close from mid-July through the end of August, we'll take the telescopes apart, lower the mirror cell, take the mirrors out, transport them to Tucson, re-illuminize them. And we usually do that once every 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so each telescope's on a different coating cycle.
Right. So this has a big mirror up there on top, facing up, inside the bowl, facing up.
Yes,
facing
yes. The primary mirror is here, and that's 40 inches in diameter, and then you can see the optical secondary
yes.
there. And then that bounces down to a filter wheel and CCD assembly that they have on the bottom
mm-hmm.
of the telescope.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all the different instruments, each one has different ways that they keep them cool. You know, some are liquid nitrogen cooled. Looks like this has like a closed circuit, like Cryo-Tiger type
okay.
cooling system on it.
So even when it's cold up here at night, even in the summer, because we're at 9,000 feet.
Yeah, in the summertime, usually you can subtract about 20 degrees.
But in the winter, it's really cold,
oh, yeah.
so they still have to cool these things.
Yes. You get this dark current in the electronics, and they're
noisy. So by keeping the instrument really cold, it makes them more sensitive and reduces
okay,
the...
Okay, tell people real simply what dark current is.
It's basically this background electronic noise in the
okay.
system.
Okay.
And when you cool the cameras... it helps reduce that noise.
Okay. Okay.
And, so this little dome right now, is Golden Gopher.
Okay. University of Minnesota telescope is what? What do they have here?
It is another 60 inch.
Whoa,
so
a big
very,
one.
Yes. It's,
ooh.
It's the twin to the one on the other end of the site.
Yeah. Okay.
And they have done a lot of infrared observing with this telescope.
So this is not a visible light telescope.
They're using it. For visible light.
You can
science.
Change them from one to the
yes,
other.
Yes, there's different
oh, okay.
there's different secondaries and there's so some secondaries are like gold plated and so there's different secondaries you can put on for doing more infrared science.
And they keep the same main mirror.
Yes, the primary stays
they
the same.
They just change out some of the other components.
Yes.
Oh, I
and
didn't
so
know that.
We and so in fact a while ago one of the U of A astronomers had an infrared camera on here. Same setup with the secondary and primary, and I forget what wavelengths he was looking at.
Mm-hmm.
But even with that existing secondary, they were able to do infrared astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
That what's unique about the infrared stuff is that the secondaries chop back and forth,
mm-hmm.
so they go on target, off target, on. So that way they can subtract the sky and
oh.
get better measurements.
Oh.
And so that mirror up there will oscillate. Which is kind of interesting. And so Minnesota hired an outside contractor to revamp their control system. So this is in a state of getting upgraded
okay.
right now. So this box is going to be their new...
And again, we have a plastic tarp over the
yes,
over
yes.
the electronics and the component
yes, yep.
of the telescope because of the leaky silo room.
Yes, that's exactly right. Just like old science fiction.
Yeah.
This is their machine shop.
Levers and dials and things like that.
Yes.
Smells like a machine shop.
Yes, all these buildings used to have oil burning heat.
Yeah. Oh.
And so that's what was in here was a boiler. And that's where the building still retains that,
yeah.
that smell.
And this is just a maze of spaghetti wires
yeah.
hanging down from the ceiling and old metal, mid-century metal office. Flat factory floor lights and computers stacked up on tables and yeah.
What's interesting about this control system that they've had is that it's all command line driven. So you know, like on Microsoft, when you want to use Word, you click on the little icons. In our telescopes have GUIs, graphical user interfaces, like
that were to move the telescope around and stuff. This is all like a Linux type thing. It's a command language called Forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so you enter in, you know, you have to enter in each command, type it in to make the telescope do something. So a little different than the way the other telescopes.
So when someone works that telescope we just looked at, they're in here to do that?
Currently. Now,
yeah.
Now Minnesota's goal in what they paid for is to start being able to use that remotely.
Okay.
So that new box out there will allow it to be able to be, like from Minnesota, they can use
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
That's their ultimate goal.
Right now when it's running, they sit here.
Yes, that's
yeah.
correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's my kind of sketchy recording of crawling in and out of telescope silo towers. Thank you, Joe, so much. You were an incredible host, and I saw things I never thought I would see when I drove up that mountain. It was just an amazing tour. So, folks, if you get a chance to get out to Tucson, get up there to Mount Lemmon and be amazed for an evening.
That was a wonderful interview, Susan. I felt like I was right there in Mount Lemmon. I could just see the mountaintops and the machinery and the telescopes. So
well,
it was pretty cool.
He took me around the mountaintop for several hours. I mean, we saw everything there, and I was just unable to get much more recording because of the conditions, you know. So it's just a little glimpse of what's up there.
Well, it's encouraging
yeah.
to me. I'm thinking about maybe I need to take a trip.
Yeah. Okay. You should.
Well, Susan, we have exciting news.
Yeah, August is a big deal.
August is a big deal. The 2026 Perseids meteor shower will peak on the night of August 12th into the early morning hours of August 13th. Stargazers can expect to see up to 90 to 100 meteors per hour under this year's ideal moonless conditions. Because the peak coincides perfectly with a new moon, there will be absolutely no moonlight to wash out the faint, colorful trails or persistent fireballs. This makes 2026 an exceptionally good year for viewing. The constellation Perseus is highest in the sky, and the Earth's rotation faces into the incoming meteors during these pre-dawn hours. The radiant rises late in the evening and is at its highest at dawn. This meteor shower rises to a peak gradually, then falls off rapidly. And the Perseid meteors tend to strengthen in numbers as the late night deepens into the wee hours before dawn. The shower is often best just before dawn. The new moon falls at 12:37 a.m. on August 12th. In fact, those lucky enough to be observing the August 12th total solar eclipse might see some Perseids during totality. However, that won't be us because the eclipse will pass over the Arctic Ocean, Greenland, Iceland, Atlantic Ocean, Portugal, and northern Spain.
Oh, well.
Oh, well. The duration of this year's meteor shower is July 14 to September 1st. This time period is when we are passing through the meteor stream in space. Under a dark sky with no moon, sky watchers frequently report 90 meteors per hour or more. In 2026, you'll have a moonless sky to watch it. The August Perseid meteor shower is rich and steady. From early August through the peak, the meteors are colorful and many of them are bright, and they frequently leave persistent trains. All of these factors make the Perseid shower perhaps the most beloved meteor shower for the Northern Hemisphere. The view looking toward the east-northeast horizon during the Perseid meteor shower is great. In 2026, the best time to watch is the after midnight through dawn on the morning of August 12th and 13th. You'll have dark skies for meteor viewing. Around the peak mornings, if you trace all the Perseid meteors backwards, they seem to come from the constellation Perseus near the famous double cluster. Hence, the meteor shower is named in honor of the constellation Perseus the hero. The double cluster in Perseus consists of two open star clusters near each other's sky dome. Amateur astronomers know them as H Persei and Chi Persei. The two clusters reside in the northern part of the constellation Perseus. Quite close to the constellation Cassiopeia, the Queen, which has a distinctive M or W shape. If you have a dark sky and find Cassiopeia, make sure you look for Perseus too. Then just scan between the two constellations with your binoculars for the two glittering groups of stars, the double cluster. They are a breathtaking pair, with each containing supergiant suns. These two clusters are located about 7,500 light years away. It's amazing that we can see these stars at all across the great span of space. Plus, we know they must be intrinsically bright stars, or we wouldn't be able to see them. Each cluster contains a few hundred stars, and indeed, these stars are young, hot, supergiant suns. They are many thousands of times more luminous than our own sun. Astronomers tell us that the double cluster lies within the Perseus arm of the Milky Way galaxy. However, our solar system resides in the inner part of the Orion arm. Therefore, looking at the double cluster, we're looking through our local spiral arm and all the way to the next spiral arm outward to the galactic center.
I didn't know. That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, there are no real connection between the meteor shower radiant and the constellation Perseus. So, let's see here. The parent comet responsible for the Perseid meteor shower is a rather large comet called 109P Swift-Tuttle. The comet orbits the sun approximately every 133 years. Lewis Swift of Marathon, New York, visually discovered it on July 16, 1862, using an 11-centimeter, 4.3-inch refractor lens telescope, much different than what's found at Mount Lemmon today. He did not report it immediately, believing that he was observing Comet Schmidt, which was found 2 weeks prior. Then 3 days later, Horace Tuttle saw it at the Harvard Observatory. Scientists calculate that the comet returns every 130 years. The last time it was seen was in 1992, and the next time it will be in 2122, 96 years from now. I can't wait. I guess I'm hoping for a heavenly watch.
You'll probably get it.
Oh, I hope so.
Well, for the best chances to view this from the Viroqua area, keep these tips in mind. Watch after midnight if possible. Travel to a dark location outside of town to avoid the light pollution. And you don't need telescopes or binoculars. You can simply find a nice place with a good view of the sky, make yourself comfortable, and lie back and relax and wait. For fun, track how many meteors you can spot and report sightings of fireballs to the American Meteor Society, which you can do on its webpage at www.amsmeteors.org. You go there and you can follow it through to their calendar and report a fireball.
So stay up late or get up really early for what promises to be a fantastic show. Susan, we're coming to the close to the end of our program today. But boy, I'm still thinking about that Mount Lemmon interview.
Yeah, that was impressive. And I think we did something a few months ago about with the guy who was looking at the near-Earth objects up there. So I thought it would be fun to add this bit of the tour. I wish I had a better recording for it, but maybe this winter we'll get a little more from them up there. Meanwhile, we want everyone to enjoy the summer nights, the fireflies, and turn out your lights and get out there in the summer sun.
I'm Carol.
And I'm Susan.